speak to the second case of the day. Safe trip home. Second case is Whitehead versus Bond. Ms. Dimkar.
May it please the Court, I'm Irene Dimkar and I represent Sarah Whitehead on this 1983 case. I'm not going to belabor the facts of this case, but I do want to stress a few things. First of all, Sarah Whitehead was a 51-year-old professional African-American woman. She worked at Children's Memorial Hospital. She had no criminal record. Her husband was an accountant at Stroger Hospital. And I mention that because these were not gangbangers, these were not troublemakers, these were two professional people who were involved in this case. On June 20th, 2008, neighbor comes to Sarah Whitehead's door and says, they're killing your son. She doesn't know who they is, you know, who they are, but she goes to the corner to see what's going on. They said, you know, her neighbor said, get to the corner right away. When she gets to the corner, she sees a large number of police officers. And that's one thing I really want to make sure is stressed here. There were between 9 to 12 police cars there. We were able to identify 18 officers who were there. There's many as 20 or 24. It's clear they outnumbered the citizens on the street, possibly 2 to 1, maybe even 4 to 1. If you take, some of the officers said that there were 4 or 5 people on the street. Some of the officers said that there was 10 to 15 people on the street. All the other officers, other than the defendants, said they came to the scene and nothing was going on. I did explain why there were so many officers there. There was a traffic stop. There was a fight with Daniel Whitehead, the son of Sarah Whitehead. Dispatcher thought...
And an effort to escape, right?
Yes. The dispatcher thought there was an officer in distress and put out a call for what they call a 10-1. Immediately, within seconds, and we had the records at trial, immediately within seconds, the officers Bond and Geyer said, this is not a 10-1. We have this under control. We're sitting on the idiot, is what they said. And so it was canceled. All the officers still came there. In fact, virtually every car from the 15th District was there. So a large number of officers are there. They clearly outnumbered any of the people on the street. So back to Mrs. Whitehead. She goes to the corner. She asks various officers about her son. She happens to ask Officer Bond, who's the one who had just had an altercation with her son. And Bond says, your son's an effing idiot. She has words with Bond. He tries then to attack her. He says, get back to the curb. He's kicking her. He's pushing her. Lieutenant Stevens intervenes. Lieutenant Stevens says, get back to the curb, bitch. She has words with him. Why are you talking to me this way? He said, put her under arrest. She's cuffed. She's arrested. She's placed into a police prisoner wagon where she stayed for about 20 minutes. And obviously, the police were trying to teach her a lesson. She had committed no crime. There's no probable cause to believe she had committed the crime. That's the plaintiff's version of what happened.
And all that came out before the jury, all the different facts based on the testimony of the plaintiff and her son. And so her background, her husband's background, that was all before the jury, right?
Yes, but what was...
As well as the defense case. So the problem I have with it is... with your case is, you know, this boils down to credibility and the jury determining who to believe and who not to believe, right?
Well, I'm saying that this is not a situation where there were mere inconsistencies. The case here, the defense here, was exceedingly improbable. It was inherently incredible, using the words of the case law. The defense was illogical. And we moved for judgment as a matter of law, and we also moved for a new trial, saying that it's impossible to, for what the defense said happened, it's impossible. They said Mrs. Whitehead was there screaming, yelling. She was a psychiatric case. She was with a surging crowd. She's trying to free a prisoner from a car. She's trying to strike Bond. Bond was there. Officer Bond was there. He was 6 to 10 feet away. No doubt he was there. He was outside the car. Daniel was inside the car. But then Bond says, I never saw anything. And that was totally incredible.
Well,
how
you know,
could
that,
he be there and not be there?
That's inconsistent with what the other officers saw, but is it impossible? When the officers show up on a scene like this, their focus of attention can be quite different depending on the different officers. They have different concerns. Bond's concern at that point is the arrestee.
Well, except the facts didn't bear that out. He's outside the car. Daniel is in the back seat of the car. There's no indication he's doing paperwork or he's involved on the computer, that he's engaging at all with Daniel in the back seat. Every officer said who saw him there said that.
Now, he's just been through a scuffle with a couple of guys, and both of them tried to get away, and he's got this guy recaptured in the back seat of the car. Isn't that where his attention is focused, possibly? I mean, isn't this an argument that the jury considered?
Well, that's what the district court said, trying to reconcile. It said that, you know, that he was in a process of arresting and processing Daniel. But the facts didn't bear that out because, as I said, Daniel's already in the car. He's outside the car. And Stack and Stevens were adamant. He was there. He was 6 to 10 feet away. She was pulling this crowd. They have a very dramatic story about what happened, pulling this crowd towards the police car. And Officer Bond would have had to have seen that. He was within 6 to 10 feet away if she is pulling a crowd. Now,
That's the weakest part of your argument, I mean, that he had to see it. I mean, when officers are involved in an unfolding situation like this, great excitement. How do we know what they see? This is something the jurors have to decide.
Well, I have a hard time in arguing this because you know that our contention is that it never happened, and Stack and Stevens made it up. And we also in our brief explained how the story came to be that Bond was identified first. He came and testified and said nothing ever happened. Later on, we identified, after months and months of discovery, identified Stack and Stevens. They had to have some kind of a story as to what happened.
And you laid that out for the jury.
We did, Your Honor. But then what we're saying is, and maybe I should just jump to the motion for the new trial, with the Mejia guidelines, the district court should have itself rendered a decision on the credibility of the witnesses and the weight of the evidence, and the district court didn't do that here. If you just put aside our motion for judgment as a matter of law, we make two arguments for a motion for new trial. One is that you've got this incredible evidence that you could excise. Okay, that's part of it. But the other part, the other prong to our motion for a new trial argument is that. You know, assuming the district court stuck with the same evidence that the jury had, and that's what those are the words Mejia uses, then the judge is supposed to render a decision as to who's credible and what was the weight of the evidence. And the judge committed the same error that was committed in the Mejia case. In the judge's decision, he said, given the conflicting testimony, none of which contradicts indisputable physical facts or laws, the jury had a reasonable basis to find probable cause and to find that the force was reasonable. So he felt that his hands were tied. He was bound by the determinations of the jury. The credibility is a jury issue because there was nothing that was indisputable. There were no indisputable physical facts or laws. It's exactly the same thing that happened in Mejia. The district court should, in the motion for new trial, should have looked at the case and said, this is what happened, this is what I believe, this is what the weight of the evidence is, and the judge didn't do that. Now, Mejia came out 11 days before the court rendered a decision on the post-trial motions. But, you know, the judge did not do the correct analysis, did not look at the case, looked in the case in a light most favorable to the defendant, not a neutral way. And I think Mejia just sets new ground rules as to how a motion for a new trial is supposed to be determined. And the judge was the one on the ground. The district court, the trial judge was the one on the ground. He saw these witnesses. He saw the police officers and their demeanor when they testified. And they were belligerent on the stand. And then also saw the plaintiff. We contended there was a miscarriage of justice, and the judge did not follow through on the analysis that should have been done in the motion for a new trial. Now, we do also claim that there are two evidentiary errors, and normally those are hard to argue to you, but these were extreme. One was the evidence, allowing evidence of the police altercation with Daniel Whitehead, James Jones, and Marcus Minette, and also testimony that the police had found a baggie with 11 smaller baggies of cocaine. Well, this was devastating to Mrs. Whitehead's case. We had a trial within a trial.
Did you ask for a limiting instruction on
that? I did. I did.
And what happened?
I had a motion to eliminate, and I said to the judge, you know, this is...
Motion to eliminate, but did you ask for a limiting instruction to the jury about that evidence?
They were told in the case that they were not to consider that evidence. However, it was like not considering the elephant in the room. It was so dramatic. I mean, every blow between the police and Daniel Whitehead came out. You know, that he had kicked the police, that they were on the ground, that they were fighting, that James Jones ran away, that Marcus Minette was there. You know, all that came out, and yet all that had happened before Mrs. White had ever gotten there.
And this instruction the court gave, did the court give the instruction before the witness testified or right after the witness testified about the cocaine? And was it also repeated, did you request it in the closing instructions?
Your Honor,
you said that the court said this can't be considered, the cocaine, the crack.
Right.
Okay. So what I want to know is when was that instruction given? Was it done at the time the testimony came in, and then at the end of the trial, did you request it to be part of the instruction?
I don't think it was at the time of the testimony. I would have to review the record again. I'm sorry. I don't know when that was.
But did you ask for it? Did you ask for the limiting instruction?
I didn't ask for the limiting instruction at the time that evidence came in.
And what about at the close conclusion of the trial?
I believe we did at that time.
And it was given then?
It was not given. It was given in a very general way regarding probable cause, what amounted to probable cause for the arrest of Sarah Whitehead.
So you didn't submit a limiting instruction to the court?
No, not a specific limiting instruction. I see I'm getting into my rebuttal time, so let me just say a couple things. The evidence was prejudicial. It was clear that there was a break in the chain of events, and that should not have come in. I would like to talk about the other evidentiary error, but I'll save it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Packle?
May it please the court. At trial, 14 witnesses, including 10 police officers, testified to their memories of a short and chaotic incident that happened 2 years earlier. The jury heard all the witnesses' accounts and reached a verdict for the officers. There's no basis to disturb the jury's credibility finding. Nothing in the officers' testimony was physically impossible. Nor did the district court abuse its wide discretion in evidentiary rulings. We urge the court to affirm. This case turned on credibility. Did the jury believe Ms. Whitehead or the officers? To upset that credibility determination, Ms. Whitehead must show that the testimony credited by the jury was physically impossible or impossible under the laws of nature. That is a high and demanding standard. Improbable testimony is not enough. And here it was not physically impossible that Officer Bond did not notice Ms. Whitehead. A number of factors could have caused Officer Bond not to see her. One was the general commotion. There was testimony by Lieutenant Stevens that this event occurred over a block-long area. There was a noisy, rowdy crowd. There were people watching and yelling at the police in different places on the block. Ms. Whitehead was one among multiple sources of commotion. In addition, Officer Bond had just been in a physical altercation with Daniel, a struggle that was violent and loud enough that a radio dispatcher hearing the struggle over the radio spontaneously called the 10-1 alert. Officer Bond also testified that once backup officers arrived, in response to that alert, who could focus on the crowd, he focused on Daniel, an understandable choice as the arresting officer. Finally, Ms. Whitehead's arrest occurred very quickly. Between all of these factors, the jury could have believed Officer Bond that he did not notice Ms. Whitehead. The jury also, of course, is free to disbelieve part of any witness's testimony. It's possible the jury found Officer Bond's testimony improbable and disbelieved that portion of his testimony that he did not see Ms. Whitehead, but also disbelieved that Ms. Whitehead, that Officer Bond acted aggressively toward her. And that conclusion, too, would have supported the verdict. There are multiple reasonable conclusions that the jury could have drawn from all the evidence. That's what juries do all the time, and that's exactly the jury's role. Lieutenant Stevens and Sergeant Stack's testimony was not the only testimony supporting probable cause in this case. So when Ms. Whitehead says that out of the 10 police officers who testified at trial, Lieutenant Stevens and Sergeant Stack were the only officers to say that Ms. Whitehead did anything to justify her arrest, that is not correct. Officer Randiness testified that she saw Ms. Whitehead yelling very loudly, being very belligerent, and looking like she wanted to fight. Officer Randiness testified about a contact card, a police document that an officer filled out on the scene. That card said that Ms. Whitehead was asked to disperse, but she refused. And Officer Theron Jones did not personally see Ms. Whitehead's arrest, but he did say that when he arrived, he was told she had acted disorderly and was interfering with the investigation. He also saw her coming out of the squadron. Ms. Whitehead contends that Lieutenant Stevens and Sergeant Stack's testimony was inconsistent with the testimony of other officers who did not recall much of anything at the scene. That doesn't raise any physical impossibility because officers saw different things depending on when and where they arrived in this block-long area and when they arrived in response to the 10-1 alert. Officer Jones, whom I mentioned, is a good example. And Ms. Whitehead argued several times in her brief that the testimony of Lieutenant Stevens and Sergeant Stack should be struck as physically impossible, but she never explains why the court should strike their testimony as opposed to the portion of Officer Bond's testimony that he did not see Ms. Whitehead, if in fact the court were to find that there was a physical impossibility here, which we of course dispute.
Now on to this next issue. I can understand that some context had to be presented about what had happened before Sarah Whitehead's arrival. But my issue is this crack cocaine. Why was the crack cocaine found in the car relevant?
Your Honor, there was a quick, fast-moving series of events that preceded Ms. Whitehead's arrival. There was really a cascade of events that began with the traffic stop of Daniel Whitehead and culminated in Ms. Whitehead's arrest. And so there was a serious line-drawing problem about where to draw the line about
well,
which...
Well, I get all that. I'll give you all that. What I want to know is about the crack cocaine. Why was it necessary that that be admitted?
As I recall, the crack cocaine did not... specifically arise until the testimony of one of the officers, and then the officer was asked whether that should be admitted, or I'm sorry, the officer was asked about the discovery of the crack, and Ms. Whitehead objected, and the court overruled the objection. The reason for why the crack was relevant was that it explained the flight of Jones and of Daniel. The police officers described the sequence of events as they had arrested Daniel for lacking a driver's license. Daniel was in the back of the police car, as was Jones, while the police were checking Jones's identification. Meanwhile, because Daniel had been arrested, Officer Geyer searched the car incident to arrest. The two, Daniel and Jones, sitting in the back of the police car saw the discovery of the cocaine. That's what caused them to become nervous. That's what caused Jones to flee once the officer opened. The officer actually was opening the door to release Jones because there were no warrants that came back from the check of his name. But having seen the cocaine, the two became nervous. Jones took off, and Daniel tried to follow. That led to the fight between Daniel and the police officers. So there was relevance to that piece of evidence.
I'm concerned about this description of the area as a high violent crime area. How was that relevant to it? The concern for the jurors was what was going on at the scene. I don't see how it matters what the officer's view of the area was or reputation of the area was.
Yes, Your Honor. The relevance of that evidence was that, number one, it supported the officer's version of events, and I can give more detail on that in a second, but it was also relevant to the officer's defense to the claim for excessive force. So the question for excessive force for the jury was their response reasonable in light of all the circumstances and facts that were known to them? And in that situation, which is a very volatile situation, which could have, as far as the officers knew, exploded into further violence, it was reasonable for the officers to handcuff Ms. Whitehead and to put her into the squad role to get some physical separation from her and the crowd and to calm the scene.
I'm not sure I understand that. That officers can act differently in terms of how forceful they are with a suspect if they're in a high violent crime area than they can in a non-high violent crime area? That doesn't seem to make sense. It would seem to me the officers can act reasonably to the situation, you know, in response to the situation they face, regardless of where it is, if it's in a...
Your Honor, that's correct, that of course officers can respond to the situation they face in any area, and if an officer had seen this type of activity in a different area, it would be reasonable to me that they could likewise respond and stop.
Sure. So why is it relevant that it's a high violent crime area?
Well, another reason the high crime area evidence is relevant is that it explains why the officers quickly made the arrest. So the officers had probable cause once they saw Ms. Whitehead moving towards the police car and failing to obey their officers to stop. But just the fact of probable cause doesn't mandate that an officer make an arrest. An officer has discretion to make an arrest once probable cause exists. And here, in the high crime area, an officer reasonably could have perceived a more urgent need to calm the scene and restore order to avoid potentially violent reactions on the part of either Ms. Whitehead herself or of onlookers to that exchange between the police. So in the presence of probable cause, which was already established by Ms. Whitehead's actions, the high crime area setting could have pushed an officer towards making an arrest and doing so immediately, without, as compared to an area without that factor. In addition, Ms. Whitehead offered her own description of the neighborhood to the jury, and so thereby alleviating any potential prejudice. And it's also with both of these rulings, both with respect to the high crime area and to the evidence involving Daniel and Jones and Minat, are of course evidentiary rulings where that is subject to the district court's wide discretion in making the Rule 403 balancing of probative value and prejudice. So as long as there's some relevance to the testimony, it's really it's within the court's wide discretion about whether that relevance outweighs the probative value. So it's an extremely high standard. Returning briefly to the evidence about Daniel, Jones, and Minat, the court gave good reasons to admit that evidence, that it was relevant to the context, it explained why Ms. Whitehead was on the scene, and it helped the jury to evaluate the truth of Officer Bond's claim that he did not see Ms. Whitehead, and to evaluate the arguments of both sides about the mood of the crowd at the scene. Again, with respect to that testimony, the court weighed the prejudice that could result from that evidence and excluded the charges and pleas of those three people. So the court was attuned to the Rule 403 weighing that it needed to make, and it did so. I'd like to respond briefly to the Mejia point that Ms. Whitehead makes. The section of Mejia that she quotes in her reply brief is just the district court noting, it shows that the district court understood Mejia. It's the district court noting that it will not strike a piece of evidence from its weighing process unless it sees that that evidence is physically impossible. And the court held that there was no physically impossible evidence, so it weighed all the evidence as a whole, as Mejia requires. I also would like to note that Officer Bond has not changed his story throughout the case. While it's not relevant to the judgment as a matter of law decision and what Officer Bond said at deposition, I reviewed his deposition, and he simply said he did not see Ms. Whitehead, which is entirely consistent with his trial testimony. It's also not clear from the record that the officers outnumbered the civilians. Ms. Whitehead herself testified that in the process of going from her house to the scene, she could have seen as many as 50 people. So it's just not clear from the record that that's its case, that the police officers outnumbered the civilians. Also, it's not the case that Officer Geyer canceled the 10-1 alert because everything was under control. The 10-1 alert goes out to officers throughout the district and beyond the district. And Officer Geyer was canceling the 10-1 because he didn't think the situation rose to the level of one where he needed assistance from officers beyond the district. It's also not the case that officers testified that Bond was focused on or was doing something other than looking at Daniel. Bond himself said that he was focused on paperwork and that he was focused on Daniel once other officers arrived. And Lieutenant Stevens saw Bond standing by his car when Lieutenant Stevens arrived, but only did so out of the corner of his eye very quickly. So it's not the case that there's a lot of evidence in the record establishing that Bond was doing things other than focusing on Daniel. The jury heard all the evidence in this case and reached a verdict for the officers. There's no reason to disturb the jury's credibility finding. We ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Stafford.
First of all, just briefly on Mejia, the trial court is supposed to render its own decision, its own opinion, independent, neutral decision, evaluation of the credibility of the witnesses and of the evidence. And the trial judge did not do that here. Committed the same error that was committed in Mejia, felt that he could not, because the evidence was not impossible, that he could not set aside the jury's verdict. And yet he had a lot that he could have commented on. All the police officers other than the defendant said that there was nothing going on in the scene. You had the defendant saying that there was the equivalent of an uprising, a race riot going on with the black citizens and the white police officers. Dramatically different testimony, contradictory, and it could not be reconciled. And the judge never dealt with that in his decision. He should have done an analysis on the motion for a new trial. That's what Mejia says. Regarding the evidentiary ruling, it is troubling that they mentioned the drugs, the bag with the 11 baggies. Of course, that means that Daniel Whitehead was a dealer of some sort. And this was brought up during the opening statement, defense counsel said, and they found a bag with 11 baggies inside. Well, what did that have to do with Sarah Whitehead? And that was something we couldn't keep out ahead of time. We ended up having a trial within a trial because we had to bring in everything that happened with Daniel and with Marcus Minette and with James Jones. In fact, as plaintiff's counsel, I had to bring that up as a preemptive move, because once I knew all the stuff about Daniel Whitehead was going to come in, I had to do what I could to blunt that evidence. And so we ended up calling James Finkley, who talked about how they were beating Daniel Whitehead. The whole case became a case about Daniel Whitehead, James Jones, and Marcus Minette. And there's a spillover effect to Sarah Whitehead. Sarah Whitehead comes on the scene. This has all happened. She's not responsible for it. She didn't know anything about it. There's a clear break in the series of events, and it should not have spilled over to her. It was prejudicial, and it did affect the outcome of the case. I would like to talk about the high violent crime area. I think that's a very serious matter because it comes up in many, many trials, and it's not dealt with well by the trial judges, and I would appreciate this court giving us some guidance. This was a leading question of the three defendants. Was this a high violent crime area? No foundation. All they said was they had worked in the 15th District. They patrolled the area. No definition of what high crime was, high violent crime, no statistics at all. The evidence was not relevant. It did not enter into the calculus of the police officers regarding probable cause to arrest Mrs. Whitehead. If Mrs. Whitehead had, in fact, tried to attack Officer Bond and free his prisoner, that would be a crime whether it was a high crime area or not. There has to be a reasonable connection between a neighborhood's higher crime area and the facts relied upon for probable cause. Now, high crime area, a high violent crime area, whatever that means, that was added at trial, the violent crime area, may be relevant in certain circumstances. And there are cases that were cited by the appellee. When there is a suspicious presence, when there's flight from a building, when there's a surveillance of a possible drug transaction, when there's an investigation going on, the fact that it's a high crime area or high violent crime area could enter into it. That was not the situation here. You can't just pull in that it's a high crime area and say this is part of our calculus for probable cause when it doesn't relate to the facts of this case. People like Mrs. Whitehead, who own a home in an area labeled high crime area, they don't have fewer constitutional rights. And their violations should not receive less scrutiny from the court because it may be in a high crime area. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.